The truth is that we are in a climate emergency. We have less than 10 years to make substantial changes to our society and way of life and our economy.
I want to stress from the outset that this pandemic is far from over.
Those who have never fought for the colours they fly should be careful about criticising those who have.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg Westminster, your daily guide to British politics. I'm Caroline Hepker.
Good afternoon, I'm Ewan Potts.
Now, the business secretary, Kwasi Kwarteng, says that we may see yet more energy companies fail. Speaking in Parliament this morning, he said that the warm home discount for energy customers is staying and that he wants a renewed Green Homes Grant, the last attempt to insulate and improve home energy efficiency, of course, having been a significant failure. Well, it comes after yet another two energy suppliers collapsed, and now more than 1.5 million households in Britain have to switch energy provider. There are fears that higher energy bills and food prices going up could see people panic buying. But Boris Johnson says that he's pretty confident that won't happen.
We've got very good supply chains, as I've been saying over the last few days. And what we're seeing is the growing pains of a global economy recovering rapidly from COVID.
And parlez-vous franglais? Well, you'll need some for this bit. The Prime Minister told France it's time to get over their anger about the nuclear submarine deal, saying, prenez un grip about this and donnez-moi un break. Well, President Biden will meet Emmanuel Macron in person next month in an effort to mend those ties. Well, joining us now is Sherilyn McCrory, Conservative MP for Truro and Falmouth. Sherilyn's leading a debate in Parliament today for Baby Loss Awareness Week, which runs from the 9th of October. Plenty on that in a moment. But first, let's discuss some of the other topics dominating the world of politics this week. As we've just mentioned, Boris Johnson's been affectionately telling France to perhaps get a grip over the submarine deal with Australia. Sherilyn, thanks for joining us today. Do you think that the French have overreacted on this, or is their grievance justified?
Oh, hi there. Thank you for having me. I think it wouldn't be fair for me to comment on the French necessarily, but I do think it's important for the UK government and for UK security to have made the deal that we've made with Australia and the US. It's extremely important for our future and, you know, part of our Five Eyes commitment going forward.
Okay. On the other hand, Boris Johnson over in the US also trying to move forward the idea of a trade deal with the US. That was brushed off by President Biden, effectively. Is that a big disappointment?
Not really. This is a trade deal with the US isn't something that was on the top of the priority list for Joe Biden and hasn't been since he became US president. It's not to say that he won't do it. I'm sure he will. But it isn't something that he had at the top of his priority list. So therefore, it wasn't something that was ever supposed to be signed, sealed and delivered this early in his tenure.
At Prime Minister's questions yesterday, Angela Rayner for Labour says the government doesn't care about working people. Do you worry that higher energy bills, tax rises and the universal credit cut are creating a perfect storm that's going to hit household incomes this winter?
I understand why people are nervous, but hopefully they won't be. I think, luckily for us, wages are going up following the pandemic. We've got 1 million job vacancies at the moment. So rather than people being worried about being stuck on welfare, we're encouraging people into work and people are doing that. And with the gas and energy prices, as you mentioned earlier, we are extending the warm homes discount. So an extra 780 households get £150 knocked off their bill each year. You know, they've got the seasonal cold weather payments, which means that there's an extra £25 a week for colder periods for certain households. And also winter fuel payments, providing £300 for extra heating bills. So there's an awful lot of extra help that is targeted. And that's the important word, targeted to the households that absolutely desperately need it, rather than just sweepstaking a £20 uplift, temporary uplift, the UC, which would actually cost the taxpayer £6 billion a year in addition to what we already pay out.
There's a great deal of controversy, though, about universal credit. And, you know, it's estimated that hundreds of thousands of people will be pushed into poverty by it being withdrawn. And the jobs that you mentioned, yes, there may be a million vacancies, but the IFS says that they're largely basically in low income roles. I mean, coming out of the pandemic, there are going to be a lot of households who are significantly worse off than they were before.
you've got to remember we are coming out of a pandemic, and you've got to remember the measures that this government has put in place since it came to power in 2010. You know, introduced the national minimum wage. You know, low-income households are £4,000 better off than they were in 2010. And the recent extension means that they're £345 better off. You know, we've got a plans for jobs. So it's not just about getting people into jobs, but it's about giving people skills to progress in those jobs. So the Lifetime Skills Guarantee ensures that everybody over the age of 18 is entitled to get level 3 qualifications, which means that they can go on and get good quality jobs. So, yes, we're feeling a hit because of the pandemic. Some people are, of course they are. You know, this is a transition, not a race to the bottom.
You represent a coastal constituency. Boris Johnson's been in New York pushing the climate change agenda. Do you think we're doing enough on climate change here in the UK?
I think we're doing a great job with what we've got. Cornwall, as you say, is at the forefront, I think, of the climate emergency in the UK. And I think what Boris Johnson's doing is delivering a really important message to the other world leaders around the globe. And he has to absolutely do that. You know, if we don't do it, who will? Thankfully, we've got an American president now who's listening. And once the American president starts to listen, everybody else does. And it's so, so important that we can bring these world leaders together in time for COP26. You know, if not now, when? We really, really have to make a change this autumn.
That on climate change, which obviously is a huge and important issue. But I also want to ask you about the debate that you're leading in Parliament, which is to mark Baby Loss Awareness Week. You're the co-chair of the All-Party Parliamentary Group for Baby Loss. We've heard actually a lot more about maternity care, which got particularly bad during the pandemic. Just the latest example of a prisoner receiving very poor maternity care and actually her newborn baby dying. What is the sense of just how big a problem this is in the UK?
That was a very tragic story. I read that as well. So I became the chair or co-chair of the All Party Group last year. I suffered my own loss in January 2019 and became a new MP in December 2019. So this has all happened quite quickly in my life. What we're trying to do is, what I would like to do is promote the idea of continuity of carer. Having been on this journey and had the privilege of becoming the co-chair of the all-party group, you meet absolute experts in the field that have been campaigning on these issues for a very, very long time. And one of the things that has struck me the most is that, when you target continuity of carer and similar initiatives towards those in the most deprived areas, actually the outcomes become very, very good indeed. So continuity of carer, meaning that a woman can see one or possibly two midwives in a team rather than being passed from midwife to midwife in a larger midwifery team, means that you know, you can pick up on issues such as smoking, potentially domestic violence, you know, dietary issues, all sorts of things that perhaps you and I might take for granted, but often can result in premature birth. And stillbirth. So it's really, really important that we take notice of this, particularly today and going forward to Baby Loss Awareness Week in October. But today's debate is also a good opportunity for parliamentarians to show their human side, if you like. Often you'll hear parliamentarians sharing personal stories of their own or from their constituents. And I think it's a really important debate. I'm very proud to lead it because it shows Parliament and parliamentarians in their best light to putting party politics away and just coming together to ask the government what they can do in order to make outcomes better for everybody.
So continuity of care is clearly something which you'd like to see improved in the NHS. Tell us what else the NHS is doing well and doing badly when it comes to babies who die before, during and soon after birth.
Well, the All Party Group was set up in 2016, and as a result of that, we now have a national care bereavement pathway, which means that women who are suffering a loss and their families get absolutely excellent care in most trusts. And I say most trusts because, you know, there's all sorts of things that you again, unless you're in that world, you don't expect to need to use it. But, you know, you have somebody with you at all times answering questions, looking after you. You can make a memory box for your baby. You can potentially stay with your baby for as long as you like rather than your baby being taken away. And all of these things are very, very important as part of the early grieving process for a family. Now, many trusts are very good at this, but it's not mandated yet. And I think the All Party Group would like to see it mandated so that every trust has to put resource into that. We need more midwives who can help with this. We need more clinical obstetricians who are trained in bereavement as well. So my experience in Cornwall was a very good experience. But where I believe we could do better is the follow-up, the bereavement therapy that a grieving family needs. And I don't think we're quite there yet. As in some areas, we do very well at that, and in other areas, we don't. And often dads and supporting birth partners might get forgotten, if you like, in so that mum gets the care that she needs, but often the wider family doesn't. And I think that often still we're left to grieve by ourselves. I mean, I don't know if you know that relationships are 50% more likely to break down once they've suffered a loss of a baby. So these are really important issues. You know, you've got to think about grandparents, siblings. This is something we still don't talk about in this country enough. You know, people people are afraid to say, you know, if somebody goes to term and their baby doesn't make it, they're afraid to say, of what to say. You can't say congratulations on the birth of your baby. People just don't know what to say. And we need to start opening up that conversation so that people aren't afraid to put an arm around somebody and show them that they care.
Let's take a look now at some of the other stories making news in the world of politics. The Foreign Secretary is pushing for Mexico's support for the UK to join an international free trade pact ahead of her visit to the country. Liz Truss wants Britain to join an agreement taking in Mexico, Canada, Chile, Japan and seven other countries. This week it emerged that negotiations for a trade deal between the UK and the US are still a very long way off.
And it's feared that cuts to universal credit will see around 600,000 workers struggling to afford food over the coming months. Citizens Advice says as many as 1.5 million people could be forced into hardship this winter following the decision to withdraw the £20 per week uplift next month. Gordon Brown writing in The Guardian this morning saying that he has never seen a government act so callously, saying that the reduction could not come at a worse time for struggling households.
Well, Sadiq Khan, London Mayor, has issued a stark warning on climate change, launching a campaign across London on the environment, saying that time is running out to act on the climate emergency. Speaking on Bloomberg TV this morning, he also warned of a perfect storm of factors pushing up the cost of living in the UK.
And it looks like the mayor and the former mayor are actually on the same page. Boris Johnson delivered a strongly worded speech to the United Nations, urging all countries to tackle climate change. He said that richer countries should help developing ones to turn away from coal. The Prime Minister also said that it's up to our generation to act, and that the COP26 climate conference in Glasgow will be a birthday of humanity in which we should choose to grow up.
Well, we've been hearing from Boris Johnson and Sadiq Khan about climate change today. But is the UK putting its money where its mouth is? Well, let's discuss this now with Nufkote Darbe, Global Climate Policy Lead for Oxfam. Thanks so much for joining us today. Developed countries have pledged to provide $100 billion of annual financing to combat climate change by 2020. But according to you, according to Oxfam, rich nations are missing that goal and may not even meet it by 2025. What should we be doing to step up that pledge?
Yes, so our analysis shows rich nations are failing to meet their climate finance commitments of meeting the 100 billion target per year by 2020. And as you said, even by 2025, they're not going to meet this goal. So this means poor nations, poor countries are going to miss between 68 to 75 billion USD over the next 5 to 6 years. So this is terrible because vulnerable countries, poor communities depend on climate finance. It's a lifeline for them. They need support to adapt to the worst impact of the climate disaster. They also need support to transition to low carbon economy. So rich countries ahead of COP, you know, we really don't have time to waste. Rich countries need to significantly increase their pledges to meet the 100 billion goal. And 50% of it has to go towards adaptation. The UN has also been calling for this. But we're nowhere near that. It's one-fourth of the climate finance that's going towards adaptation. And, you know, developing countries have been calling for this.
Nafkoti, I just was going to jump in and say Boris Johnson has already sort of tried to downplay the idea that, you know, he's going to pull a rabbit from a hat and find the $100 billion at COP26 in Glasgow. He's dampening that idea down. But even when it comes to actually the financing itself, there's a lot of concern that it's coming largely in the form of loans. Is there a risk that, you know, it's piling yet more debt on?
Oh, definitely. Our analysis from 2018 and also from the OECD report that came out recently looking at 2019, it shows that 70% of the climate finance is being given to developing countries in the form of loans. So this is increasing debt on poor countries who have, you know, contributed least to the climate crisis. So rich countries, it's not only about the money, you know, increasing the pledge, but they also have to ensure that this finance is being given in the form of grants so that poor countries are not further indebted. There's, you know, the COVID crisis, the economic crisis, and now they're faced, in addition to the climate crisis. So we really have to ensure that this climate finance is being given in the form of grants.
A lot of developing countries are poorly governed. There's a lot of corruption in a lot of places. Do we need to worry about how this money is being spent, whose pockets it's going into?
Of course, we need to monitor how this finance is being dispersed. And we also need to ensure that this finance is reaching local communities. And I think analysis shows only 10% of climate finance is reaching local communities. So, starting from wealthy countries, how they're giving the finance, there needs to be really strong accounting, how they report their finance. Also from the receiving end, you know, from developing countries, of course, there also needs to be strong monitoring mechanisms in place.
Whilst the US and the UK sort of point to others to make changes and say that they're taking the lead in terms of climate change, how robust do you think Britain's plan is to reach net zero? We have a kind of top line goal, but there's some concern that actually delivering on that, there isn't the detail.
I don't have a lot of information on Britain's net zero, but our concern on the overall net zero from Oxfam is, you know, it's the IPCC, the science has made it clear that by 2050, all countries need to reach net zero by 2050. But what we're worried about is, you know, if this climate solution is going to have an impact on developing countries in terms of poor communities' access to land, and also if it's going to have an impact on access to food and so on. So we need to ensure, you know, these climate solutions, net zero, are real zero, meaning they should be separated. What's your emissions reduction by 2030? Is this going to put you on a 1.5 path? By 2050, same thing. Are we going to reach net zero, meaning are we going to reduce to the point of reaching zero? And of course, there needs to be another target in terms of how much are you going to rely on carbon removal methods.
What's your takeaway from the UN General Assembly meeting? Do you see any signs of progress, anything hopeful coming out of the meeting?
I would say the action taken so far has been woefully inadequate. We've seen, you know, on Friday, the latest UN analysis says, you know, there's going to be a 16% global emissions is going to go up by 16%. That's really bad, especially for poor countries. And we have a very limited time up to COP26. So, you know, this discussion has taken place for the past 5 years since the Paris Agreement, actually even way before that. So there are, of course, positive things coming out, like the U.S. increasing their climate finance pledge. Also China saying, you know, they're going to stop their support for overseas coal projects. So these things are really good. But at the same time, in terms of what is needed, we're far away from it. Mm. So we really have to make sure all these countries, especially wealthy countries, need to commit to increase their climate finance. But even more than that, all these countries need to come together and reduce emissions by 45% by 2030. So how are we going to achieve that?
Well, China. President Xi Jinping saying that China would end funding for international coal power plants, the funding that it gives for power plants overseas. I mean, that was one pledge from the UN. Is that anywhere near enough? Or is it China sort of shirking what it needs to do domestically?
So the China's commitment, of course, you know, we really welcome that. And it's huge because in terms of coal finance, China's one of the countries that provide a lot of support, especially overseas. So definitely this is a positive achievement. But is that going to bring us close to what is needed to reduce emissions by 45%? Is that going to bring us close to, you know, what is needed to limit warming to 1.5? Not really, you know. All other countries, whether it's the U.S., EU, like the biggest emitters, and especially the wealthiest, need to do even more in terms of their fair share, given their historical responsibility in terms of emissions.
As we look ahead to COP26, are you hopeful? Do you think that the world will come together and do what needs to be done?
It's not about hope. I think we really don't have a choice. We really don't have a choice. Just at 1.1 degree warming, we're already experiencing extreme weather events. Like right now, Madagascar, hundreds of thousands of people are experiencing hunger. You know, this is a tragedy. So ahead of COP26, if we are going to have a chance to limit warming to 1.5, and this is critical, then we have to do everything within our power. Like all countries have to come together to reduce emissions, and wealthy countries need to increase climate finance.
Bloomberg Westminster. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.